We're reading from John chapter 20, starting at verse 19. On the evening of that first day of the week, this is the day that Jesus rose. On the evening of that first day of the week, when the disciples were together with the doors locked for fear of the Jewish leaders, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." After he said this, he showed them his hands and side. The disciples were overjoyed when they saw the Lord. And again Jesus said, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, I am sending you." And with that he breathed on them and said, "Receive the Holy Spirit. For if you forgive anyone's sins, their sins are forgiven. If you do not forgive them, then they're not forgiven." Now Thomas, also known as Didymus, and that means twin, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We've seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." And he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." Then Jesus told him, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which were not recorded in this book. But these were written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. Thomas counts. Whenever we see Thomas, a number is not far away. When he's listed, he's one of the 12. He's a twin. In the chapter after this, they're out fishing, and lo and behold, the number of fish is recorded very specifically as 153. Thomas is there. Thomas counts. When he's convinced of something, he'll do anything. When Jesus told his disciples that they were going up to Jerusalem despite the dangers and threats, it was Thomas who said, "Let us go, that we may die with him." He's strong-minded, he's loyal, but he needed to know in order to believe. He needed to see things, he needed to check. One of the delightful stories I have of marriage is of, this is a nice little sidetrack, is of a husband and wife, and the wife would get miffed because the husband would say, "Have you locked the door?" And she would say, "Yes." And then he would go and check the door. "Oh, what did you ask me for?" And it was just one of those sort of life's irritants. And one day God spoke to her and said, "I made him a door checker." That's what he does. That's why he's so good at his job. He was an accountant. That's why he saved people's businesses. He checks. "You love him because I made him like that." Oh. God makes door checkers and loves them. And Thomas is one of those who just could not take the word of other people unless he had seen for himself. His friend had seen Jesus, had seen he's alive, but he couldn't believe. He just couldn't. How could this possibly be true? We all know that dead men don't come back to life. He knew that Jesus had died, and logic told him that he must still be dead. Martin sent a hymn which has two verses to this. The vision of his, meaning Thomas, the vision of his skeptic mind was keen enough to make him blind to any unexpected act, too large for his small world of fact. His reason certainties denied that one could live when one had died, until his fingers read like braille the markings of the spear and nail. Returning from South Asia, I discovered a world that I had forgotten existed. This is a world that doesn't have much place for the spiritual. Living in South Asia, everything is spiritual. People have all sorts of understandings of ghosts and demons and spirits and angels and God, and here it's very secular. And that was new to me. This world values science and measurement and physical materialism and struggles and often can't see God. And I've seen this eating away at some of my friends' ability to follow Jesus. For them, it's really hard to believe. And this is mostly men. And it's a bit of an epidemic. The ability to hold fast when the world is saying, and science seems to be saying, something completely different. They feel that they can't see enough evidence for God. Now, if this isn't a struggle for you, and I know there are people out there that isn't, keep listening. Because there are others out there who need you to understand where they're coming from. We, like Jesus met Thomas, we need to meet people in their need and help them. This worldview understands faith in a very particular way. The definition of faith that is becoming stronger and stronger is belief without evidence. Who's heard that? The idea of belief without evidence is faith, which is then seen as kind of strange, odd, weird. Why would you believe something for which there is no evidence? And I know Christians who agree with this definition. And they point to Hebrews, where Hebrews 11 says, now faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. And Christians say, you have to have faith to believe in Jesus. And those who say, well, belief without evidence is stupid. But this misunderstands entirely what Hebrews is actually saying here and what faith means. This definition of faith being belief without evidence is actually quite a new definition and is ironically based on no evidence. The word faith is about being true to what we know is right. It doesn't say how we know it. It's once we know it, we're true to it. The word, Latin word is fide, from which we get the word fidelity. You know, being true to, high fidelity, true sound. We have and Hebrews 11 is about people who had enough evidence, enough experience to know God. And then when things turned difficult, they stayed true to it. They had the experience, they had the evidence that they needed, and they stayed true to it. Faith is about being faithful, even when it's dark and you can't see. But science is very good at seeing. It's about looking at things. It's about measuring things. It's about objectively sensing things and trying to understand them. And we have another idea that's crept into our society, that science and religion are seen as being in opposition. Again, I'm sure you've heard people say that science is one thing, religion is opposed to it. Science is about fact, and Christianity is about faith. And again, this is twisting the situation. Science, Christianity, for certain, aren't in opposition. In fact, scientific method grew up and flourished in a Christian world. It didn't flourish in any other cultural setting. It had to have a Christian milieu, an understanding of a God who created the world and held it true, that we could then, it was then worth looking at and understanding. So no other culture, no other background developed scientific method. So both science and Christianity have a long and positive relationship. The fact, the idea that they're in opposition is again twisting things. We need both science and philosophy, science and revelation. And that both are part of faith. And yet we see people, a lot of men, not in the way of Jesus anymore. They struggle to believe. And they often can't believe. And what's fed this is a lot of ideas. Interesting word, the idea of memes. There's a lot of memes, ideas out there that are now embedded in our society. Who's heard the one, religion causes war? Who believes that, actually? Religion causes war. A lot pointing to it, isn't there? Somebody says to you, religion causes war. How do we begin to answer that? Well, I would answer scientifically. Let's look at how many wars were caused by religion. Makes sense, doesn't it? There's in a book called The Encyclopedia of War. And they've examined over 1,200 wars through history. The number of wars that they say, that their analysis is, that is dominantly caused by religion, or religion was a major part of it, was 7%. And if you take out Islam, it's less than 3%. Science. Counting, looking. Religion causes war. Well, actually, yes, to a point. Of course it does. Christianity's been involved in awful violence. But it is less than 3% of all fighting in war. Again, there's an idea that floats around in our society that said Jesus never existed. Jesus was made up. He's not an historical person. There's an awful lot of this that floats around. And you can say, well, where did the Gospels come from? Well, Paul made them. Paul lied, wrote them up. No. And it's a understanding based on suspicion and dislike rather than real history. No historian is saying this. If you look at the background of people who are making a career out of saying this sort of thing, they've never really studied history. And yet we live in a society where there are ideas like Christianity is represented by the Crusades. Christianity, when in its day all it did was burn heretics. Christianity is represented by homophobia. Christianity is represented by seventh-day creationists and anti-science. Christians believe what there is, something for which there is no evidence. You think there's evidence? Show me the evidence. You're all deluded. That wonderful word, delusional. I'm not sure if any of you have had that thrown at you, but it's a very interesting one because it's taking the language of mental health and applying it in a way that is awfully rude to people who struggle with mental health issues. It's very shaming. It's taking the shame of mental health. How dare they? There are people out there who really struggle. Over 10% of us will at some stage have mental health issues. And to take that shaming language and use it as a weapon, crikey. And yet, when you listen to the people who say these sorts of things, very, very often, underneath it, there is hurt. Very often, there's a story of rejection where something happened that didn't work out. Maybe prayers weren't answered. Maybe somebody they know was suffering. Maybe a church rejected them for who they were. It's well worth listening to the stories behind the accusations. But in our world, the need to see is very, very real. And while Jesus says to Thomas, "Blessed are those who believe but have not seen," he's also taken the time to show himself to Thomas. He met Thomas where he was needed. And we live in a culture that needs to see, needs to measure. Thomas could see the healed trauma. Jesus says, "Look, touch." And Jesus is fine with that. He accepts Thomas where he is. We shouldn't be saying to our world, "No, just believe." That's not good enough. We've actually got to say, "Look, touch." But how does Jesus show his healed wounds today? How could we even begin to do that? Well, there's certainly lots of trauma and wounds in this world, isn't there? And from the olive press of Gethsemane and the cross, healing flows. And I'm sure we all have stories of being touched by Jesus, changed by Jesus, turned around by Jesus, healed by Jesus. And just as Thomas saw the healed wounds of Jesus, so people can see the healing that Jesus brings today to real people. Our healed trauma shows God in action for our neighbors, for our friends to look at, to watch. Our trauma, the wounds we carry, can become sacramental. What do I mean by that? It means that we can join with Jesus in his death, and doing so, we're joined with his resurrection. And others can see that change and understand. And they can look and see life. My time in Bangladesh was often talking with believers from a Muslim background. Now you can imagine that life for people who have decided to follow Jesus, and they will not use or very rarely use the word Christian in public, because that's a lightning rod. But they will say, of course, we follow Jesus. A life for them is not simple. A friend of mine called Hassan Ali came to faith well over 15 years ago, and when he did, all hell broke loose around him. He was beaten. His wife tried to poison him. He was locked in a room that were without drink and without water, and it was just before the rainy season, so it's 36 degrees outside and humidity of over 90%, and he's locked in a room without water for 72 hours. Just trying to get him to turn around. He didn't. And his wife came to believe. His wife was one of the main instigators behind a lot of this. And his wife came to believe. Why? Because he never hit her through that year of where she was causing all sorts of problems. And that was a change. That was new. Something in him had changed that he would not hit her. Whereas previously, that was part of their marriage. And through all of that, his prayer was, Father, they don't know what they're doing. Forgive them. I had the joy of interviewing him. I had 22 pages of him talking through his life story. Just, I read it again the other day. Words, Father, forgive them. Because they don't know what they're doing. Real echoes of the one he followed. Why was I reading his story? Because the week before Easter, he was killed. He was killed by evil people who hate the idea of following Jesus. And 15 years after he made that decision, he paid for it with his life. And yet I know he would be saying, forgive them. They don't know what. And if people come to faith because of his life and response to violence, like his wife did and his family did, I know now all his family except for one daughter-in-law are believers. And that came out of his response to wounds and violence. They saw the change. Out of his death, we pray, the same thing happens. So the testimony of people who know resurrection power in their life is powerful. It's our story. We should look at us and see the wounds, see the trauma, and the healing that God has brought. Our testimony matters. Interestingly, the idea of testimony, idea of being in court and giving a statement, testifying, is very John, the Gospel of John. If you read the first chapter of John, the idea of testimony or witness, it comes again and again and again. Forgotten. I did count it last week, and I forgot to write it down, but I think it's over five times in that very first chapter, you have the idea of testimony or witness. We are on in a part of a trial. We're called just to give our story. That story is powerful, and it counts. We can say what we have experienced. I'm sure all of us have stories of change, stories of healing, stories of resurrection power at life, things that were lost and given over as dead and brought back because God. Dreams lost and restored. Be a collector of stories. listen to people's stories? Do we actually know each other's stories? How did you come? Have we ever asked each other, how have you come to faith? What has your faith walk meant? What's happened? What are the significant periods of faith walk that you've had? Because our stories bolster each other. I collect stories, particularly stories from Muslim background believers, people who were Muslim and now follow Jesus. I had the real fortune to meet a lady from a war-torn country. And her story was that having come to the UK, her daily practice was to read the Quran and meditate on it and pray. And she was becoming more and more unsettled in this. It wasn't, she describes it as saying, it just wasn't right, but she couldn't put her finger on what was right. And then one day, she was in her lounge and she felt, she had her eyes closed and she felt a man walk into the room. And yet it wasn't a scary experience, it wasn't anything that suggested or was being sinister, and all she felt was a sense of peace, and then the man walked out. A wee while later, again, the reading of the Quran, etc., is not sitting well with her, and she was having read the Quran in her living room, a man walked in. Someone she didn't know. And it's really hard. She was talking not in English. It was being translated. It's hard to know. Did she know this was a vision or was this somebody real? But physically, she talks as if it was a real physical. And the person stood there and she said, felt this overwhelming sense of peace. And the person said, I am the Good Shepherd. A little while later, left. Very meaningful experience for her, but she didn't know the meaning of it. So she's on a bus, and she hears two people in front of her, and they're Christian in their language. And she thinks, well, maybe Christians know about this. So seriously, she leans forward and says, excuse me, but if somebody was to say, I am the Good Shepherd, what would that mean? It turns out that these two students were students from the Oxford Centre for Apologetics. And the weird thing is, they said, this is where I sort of go, what? They said, yes, we know what that's about, but we've got to get off the bus. Give us your phone number and we'll contact you. And I'm just going, no! Why? This bus ride's certainly got to be more important than whatever you're going to. But they did. They took her number and got off, but they did get in touch with her. Somebody who says, I am the Good Shepherd. What does that mean? And her life of change. There are now 30 from her culture in a particular city who come from a Muslim background who have been significantly changed, all with stories of healing and of grace. Another friend of mine from a Pakistani background here in the UK had a dream. And in this dream was shown a beautiful garden with children playing and a man playing with the children and welcoming her. But outside of the garden, it was grey and it was dark and it just faded off. And a sense of, are you going to make a choice? She doesn't know what this means, but a couple of weeks later, she's in London and she goes into a place which she thinks is a museum, but it's not a museum, it's a church. And there's a picture of the man that she saw in a dream. So she asked somebody, who is that? She had no idea. That man, of course, was, it was a particular, a depiction of Jesus. She had never seen it before. Why that particular depiction came into her dream, you can't explain that. It just did. Story after story after story of people I know and have sat down with. And you know what? I reckon if we were to sit down with each of us here, we would get stories and understandings that are just as real. Just as, what? How did that happen? The last story I want to tell you of is a dear friend of mine, pastor, who was, I think I may have told you this before. I know I have my son sitting there going, yeah, I heard that one, But this pastor friend of mine was an evangelist, and he was going to a certain city, a certain village in Bangladesh, and there were people there showing real interest, and again, he was warned by men, if you come back, we will kill you. We do not want this in our village. So he thought about it and prayed about it and started going back. And again, the response is warm from the people he's dealing with. Nothing happens. And he goes back again. Nothing happens. On about the fourth trip, he's coming back from the village. And he's now in a small area of trees. The road goes through a small area of trees and bamboo. And two guys jump him. And they've got a spade and I've got a gun. They said, we told you not to come. And he said, okay, let me pray before you kill me. So he kneels down and he tells the story of, as he knelt, he just felt covered in light. And he's praying, thinking, and the gun's physically against the back of his head. He can feel the gun. And a noise happens, and a noise happens. And then nothing happens, and then something. And after a while, he feels this gentle breeze, and he looks up, and there's no one there. So he continues home. Again, he has to think about, what do I do? Well, he carried on going to the village. And we know what happened there, because at least one of the guys, I think both of them, but at least one of the guys that jumped him, became a Christian. What had happened is they had pulled the trigger, and nothing had happened. They thought the gun must be not working. So they got the spade and went like this to smack him on the back of the head with it, because he's kneeling praying. And something pulled the spade out of their hands. Now, these are people who believe in ghosts and evil spirits, and they just think, we're in this place that's vastly evil, that's got some sort of powerful force here, and there's no one else there. The spade is yanked out of their hand. They know something's going on, and they run away. And then they listen to his story, and they come to faith. And there we have the story of Hossein Ali. All these people are facing violence and trauma and fear and injustice and lies and rubbish. And they stick true. Now, Hossein's story ends in one way. Nehemiah's story ends in another. And we can say, why? And Jesus says, because I am the resurrection. Hossein's story is not finished. Jesus is the resurrection. All of these people have bowed and with Thomas said, my Lord and my God. We all need to come to that. Is he the whole, that multiply asked question, is he Lord of all? his mission shaping the way we use money and time and relationship and effort and leisure and the internet. In all of that is, are we saying my Lord and my God? I put this bit for Tim Davie. It's Chris Wright, a quote from Chris Wright, who says, Jesus did not give a mission to his church. He formed a church to do his mission. Without the mission, it's not a church. It's just a group of disobedient Christians hanging out. The phrase, my Lord and my God, calls us to mission, the task of being sent. When we say, my Lord and my God, we commit ourselves to helping bring change to this world, to bring healing and wholeness and life and good news and abundant life and joy. We won't go far on this mission until we are convinced that he is Lord, that he is risen. We are called to help each other see that. We have our own stories, but as we share those, so the understanding that Jesus is alive, Jesus is working. Wonderful headline in The Independent today about Justin Welby. Oh, I was thinking, how many times is the name Justin Welby going to be mentioned in sermons today? I hope in every church. Say, the headline in The Independent says, his life will speak more than 1,000 sermons. And our lives, each can speak more than 1,000 sermons. Our life as a community showing healing trauma may not be completely healed, but certainly healing. And may we all together learn to say, my Lord and my God.